Welcome to The Vinyl Preacher, your weekly podcast where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Matt Cadle, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church and Campus Ministry in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Zach Barris. I am the pastor of Lutheran Campus Ministry at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Here we are, Zach. It's August.
It is August, Matt, and I think we got to talk about the news. I've talked to a number of our listeners in the past, and one of the things that I've learned from our listeners is that for many of them, this is the primary place they come for news about current events, about the world. And so we have a duty to these listeners to provide them with up-to-date information about the goings-on of the universe, you know?
Right.
And the thing, Matt, that I think is really important for us to talk about this week is Sermongate. I know you've been traveling the world. Have you heard about Sermongate?
No, tell me.
Oh, Matt, this is a New York Times article here about Sermongate. It prompts a quandary. Should pastors borrow words from one another? It's come out of this like Southern Baptist Convention controversy. You know, they had a really heated election and stuff. And so the guy who won, whose name isn't very important to us, Ed Littleton, I believe. Ed Litton. His detractors have gone back and found lines in his sermons that he has lifted from other people. In particular, he does this bit on, oh gosh, what is it? On, it's like a list of things. It's, five selves, that signify hostility to God: self-will, self-glory, self-gratification, self-righteousness, and self-sufficiency. And then they put it right next to, YouTube videos where you can find some other, Minister Greer, preaching these. Mr. Greer says that he asked for permission, and Litton apologized for not giving credit. Matt, quick question here in our A block today. How do you approach stealing, borrowing, reinterpreting the intellectual property of other preachers?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much what it's about, right? Attribution. You kind of it's like any other kind of plagiarism, I would think.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard at this point to not, I mean, of course, like, you're going to borrow themes and, you know, things that you pick up along the way. It's about attribution, though. I mean, isn't it that simple? Or is there more to it? What am I not getting?
Well, I'd say, Matt, that I'm not sure attribution, like, I don't think, you know, we're pretty pro academia here on the podcast and like footnotes as much as anybody, but I'm not sure sermon as performance art should read like a research paper or sound like a research paper. And I think there is.
Yeah, I mean, footnote. Yeah, I mean, I understand you can't pause and say footnote, but I mean, I set it up like a similar thing happened. This wasn't like the Sermongate that you're talking about, but when the documentary on the Black Church came out, that documentary begins with Otis Moss preaching this just incredible riff. Like, it's just this incredible riff about who has the power, and it's so good. But he actually borrowed it from someone else, and he knew that, and in the sermon he like had attributed it. But of course, when you make a documentary, you like cut things. So they just had him doing the riff. And so he had this whole public post just, like, apologizing and saying, you know, I didn't know that this was how it was going to be edited, but I just want you all to... And he had to, like, you know, this isn't original to me. Now, clearly he performed it well. Like, if you were performing a cover song and you were like, holy, like, that was really... That was great. I remember a few years back, Bishop Yehiel Curry, come on the pod, Bishop Curry, preached a sermon at the Western States Youth Gathering that ended up being about, like, a sacrifice bunt in a baseball game. And it was, like, the sacrifice was the key part. But it was so fire. Like, the way that he set it up. I mean, the way that he carried it through. Like, it just... And we were talking, like, some of the other preachers in the room. You know, like, when you know when the preachers are impressed with the preacher? Like, there's something... and we were like somebody was like, I've heard people preach on that before, but I've never heard it that good, you know? Like, so you can take like a familiar theme or like a take on something and do it in a different, you know, like there's like, there's room for that. So I'm not like opposing, it's not like everything has to be 100% original. I mean, I would approach the attribution, like you said, like you can't like pause and say a footnote, but like I set up like a story usually. Like if I'm going to quote Dr. King, I'll like set the context and then I'll be like, and then I try really hard because you can't like, quotes are hard to do, but you're just like the words of so-and-so, like just, but I try to do it in a storytelling kind of way, you know, not like a footnote 1A, you can find this in, you know?
Yeah. I think it's actually a pretty difficult question. I think it's overblown in the Times article that came out because it's clearly within the context of this like power struggle within the Southern Baptist Convention. And there's all that political stuff going on, and the exam, like I don't think it folks would care nearly as much if that wasn't going on. But I think it starts to get really gray really quickly. Like I use Rorbal Molina's social science commentary all the time in my prep, but also occasionally I drop like nuggets out of it. And I don't source it, right? Like, and I don't think their like work is any less valuable than like the poetic work of another preacher that I would be could either quote directly or take some significant artistic inspiration from and direction from. The one that I thought of most is one time I told Mike Birbiglia's sleepwalking story as if it. A lot of it as if it were mine, and then it like morphed into these different, like into the Jacob dream wrestling at the Fort of the Jabbok story, right? And if I attributed it during the middle, it would have killed it because I'm it's like when I've occasionally done like these kind of like magical realism sermons where I'm trying to draw you into like things and make you start questioning like reality, you know?
It's like, can we put that on the next t-shirt? It's like when I do these magical realism sermons, and I just want to make you start questioning reality. The vital preacher.
That's right. And I don't know that it's ever going to be an issue for me, personally, because the context is so different, right? Like, I'm so clearly not making any sort of, gaining any sort of, like, financial advantage by doing these things. You know, it's almost like, I'm proud of my children's sermon this week, Matt. I did a children's sermon this past week at Cross of Christ Lutheran Church in Broomfield. And I went for it, Matt. I don't normally go for it with children's sermons. In supply preaching, they're pretty difficult. But it was the dancing stories of David dancing naked and John the Baptist and the dance that leads to his death. And so the big punchline I came up with was, you know, you can't just talk about it, you got to be about it. And so we're going to dance for the children's sermon. And I spent the night before learning Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody on guitar. And I brought all of my instruments, and I made the congregation stand up and sing and dance to I Want to Dance with Somebody, and I gave out instruments to all the kids and stuff.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, right? It was fantastic. And I did not attribute it to Whitney Houston. So I can only imagine. Right? I didn't get the licensing. I didn't do any of that. And I'm going to guess that nobody cares.
Except when a kid hears Whitney Houston on the radio doing that song, and they go, that's what Pastor Zach's, that's Pastor Zach's song.
Because we do, like, we cover, I mean, I hate the sermons where they're just source, like, they're footnoting all of the scripture they're quoting the entire time. Right? But that our world, the world of the preacher, straddles this world of artistic creation and expression and that needs protection, and the world of oral tradition, where it's not really important. Like, the point of the Bible is not necessarily who wrote it, I don't think, in that sort of final sense, but creating this thing that almost exclusively throughout the Bible was an oral tradition passed down, and no one got attribution, and so everybody gets to be a part of it. So,
ooh, now you're making me question reality.
Oh, that's right.
Is this a magical realism podcast?
This is the preeminent magical realism preaching podcast. Number one in Honduras and around the world. We should do that. We should start a spinoff podcast, the Gabriel Garcia Marquez preaching podcast.
Yes. Yes, we should.
One shout out to listeners, Matt. I got one shout out, and then we can rock and roll. To Deb Inquist, who's a pastor here in the Boulder area, who texted me recently to express her appreciation of the podcast, but also her dissatisfaction that we had not updated the Spotify playlist that week. So, number one, I mean, shots fired. If you're Ben Adams or Will Rose, some of our other listeners, because Deb Inquist is following up. She knows when we don't update the Spotify playlist. So nothing made me happier than knowing that the Spotify playlist I update occasionally every week is somebody else is actually looking at it. So
amazing. Amazing. Well, we'll get on that. Get on that.
Oh, we're up to date now.
Good. Good.
Got to keep Deb
happy. Well, now that we have covered the news and updated the Spotify playlist, we can talk about the texts.
T for T. Matt, this just drops out of nowhere. I'm a little fussy about this Old Testament reading. We've had continuous... This puts the semi in semi-continuous. Since we last talked, evidently David has had a son who's led a revolution. And that's where we find ourselves. But you don't get any of that stuff.
Yeah, we've missed so much. Absalom, though, again, I mean, you could do multiple seasons of this this drama on HBO. So mm-hmm. HBO Max, you just canceled Lovecraft Country.
What?
Now is the time.
They canceled Lovecraft Country?
Yeah, they're not doing it. They're not moving forward with season two, which is really disappointing.
That is super disappointing.
But the creator did sign a deal with Netflix, I think. So maybe we'll get a season two over there. I don't know. Oh. I really love that show. But I'm telling you, HBO Max, if you got room now on your schedule, do this David narrative. It's really good, and it continues today to be really good with King David zooming ahead to talking about his son Absalom. I do remember the ending. I don't know why I remember the ending, but I remember it from Sunday school, and I don't remember why. I don't know if there's a children's Bible that talks about this or what, but this last line. Anyway, here's how it starts. A reading from 2 Samuel. King David ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders concerning Absalom. So there we are, dropped right into the middle of the narrative. Thank you for giving us the recap. So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. Be good, sounds like Endor. Mm-hmm. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David, and the slaughter there was great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest claimed more victims that day than the sword. What?
Ents, man. They're tough.
Ents! Ents! Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak. Now, I have not gotten a haircut in over a year, so my hair is getting pretty long. I know you've got the man bun going now.
Yeah.
I've just got it all. I've got the whole, it's just all over the place. So I'm just going to avoid riding my mule under the branches of a great oak.
Yeah.
Because when Absalom did that, his head was caught fast in the oak, and he was left hanging between heaven and earth. What a line. While the mule that was under him went on. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him.
Oof.
So they definitely got the memo from David about dealing gently with the young man. Then the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, "Good tidings for my lord the king, for the Lord has vindicated you this day, delivering you from the power of all who rose up against you." The king said to the Cushite, "What about the young man Absalom? Is it well with him?" And the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to do you harm be like that young man."
Ooh.
And the king was deeply moved, and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept.
Oh.
And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Word of God, word of life.
Thanks be to the Ents. Matt,
I mean, that basically preaches itself.
It does.
You know.
It does. But should you be a not very good or insightful preacher, let me give you a little context. A few things you need to know, fun facts, because we just introduced and killed Absalom in the same episode. And it turns out he's a bit of a main character here. Absalom, here's the main, my headline. Absalom was more beautiful than David.
What?
The scriptures go on and on about how beautiful he was and loved by everyone for his charm and beauty. And yet, man, he rebels and he leads what appears to be a pretty successful revolution. Most of the army follows Absalom, and so David and his small band of loyalists are on the run, and they have to go hide on the other side of the river in modern-day Jordan. But David, who's cunning, has cunning in addition to his great beauty, he plants a mole in Absalom's court who successfully sabotages his son. In particular, the saboteur convinces Absalom not to attack David's army while they're on the run. And this allows David's army to build up his forces and allows David to draw Absalom's forces out so that the battle happens in the thick forest of Endor. I mean, Ephraim, where the numerical advantage that Absalom had would be diminished. Yeah, so Absalom's riding a mule as well here, Matt. The mule, according to my resources that are in the footnotes in the episode description, was the royal mount of the house of David. So you have this symbolic thing of Absalom being taken, having the kingdom taken away from him. It's the kind of, I mean, I see it in my head as kind of a Robin Hood Prince of, What's the satirical Robin Hood movie?
Men in Tights?
Men in Tights, yeah. One of those kinds of deals where he is he gets stuck in the tree and the kingdom is taken away from him. His hair does get caught up there, Matt, and it's the hair, which is another symbol of his, like, vanity, you know? His big, beautiful hair is his downfall, which is scary news for people like you and me. With thick, beautiful locks that could get stuck into trees. And then there's some pre-existing beef between Absalom and Joab. In particular, Absalom one time set Joab's crops on fire.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, which sounds like vandalism, you know, until you also remember in the ancient Near East, not having enough food to eat is a way that you died.
Right.
And his house might have died, so... And then, kind of a fun fact, so David gets all upset here, right? If only I died instead of you. And yet, according to tradition and in the text that gets cut out here, Absalom is buried under, there's a monument for him. It's a giant pile of rocks, and he's in the bottom of it. And that was a form of burial reserved for cursed people, right? The implication is that you're stoned to death.
Wow.
Complexity.
Yeah.
And beef.
Yeah. Well, like we said, incredible storytelling that continues through this narrative. But how do you preach on this? If you were to choose this as your text for preaching, what do you do with it?
I mean, the most obvious good news, I think, is David's love of his son. Even when he takes away everything that he cares about, or takes his kingdom away from him. And some of the... This is partially... We're not going to get it in the readings for next week, but this is a story on the downfall of David here, because Joab and the people who are loyal to David... the people who are loyal to David get upset with David about how much he, like, still loves this son who betrayed him, and so he's not rewarding in their eyes loyalty the way that they feel like he should. And so this is a position that does not... David's love of Absalom does not help him in the political world, and there's a cost that he's going to have to pay for that. But he's willing to pay it.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Also, the irony, Matt, like, this just rings back to a couple weeks ago with Uriah the Hittite, who David's instructions were, make sure you get that guy to the front. Right. And he doesn't work out the way he wanted. And
yeah.
And then he's like, make sure nobody hurts that guy. And that doesn't work out the way he wanted.
Doesn't work out. Doesn't work out. Either. Yeah. Yeah. Even kings cannot manipulate everything. Maybe that's good news. Kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I kind of just like the messiness of it, you know?
Mm.
That I'd set it up for good news. My main good news pull will probably come out of the gospel here. But I like how incredibly messy this story is and how it's full of broken relationships. That our picture of David as Christians, you know, mostly gets told through the lens of Jesus, and David was great and everything was wonderful back then. And for your church nostalgia looking backwards, actually no, it's just different, but just as messy, right? And broken relationships and stuff. And yet, that's the place. This is the place where God works.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about the gospel.
Oh, Matt, buckle up, because we are here deep into the dog days of summer. School has not yet started back here, but this is week one of three of the bread from John. This is week one. Most of August is going to be bread from John out of this one passage. So pace yourselves, dear preachers. You've got this metaphor for 3 weeks. So do what you can with it here. Let's do it. Jesus said, I am the bread of life, and whoever comes to me will never be hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. But then the Judeans began to complain about him because he said, I am the bread that came down from heaven. And they were saying, is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he now say, I have come down from heaven? And Jesus answered them, do not complain among yourselves. No one can come to me unless drawn by the Father who sent me. And I will raise that person up on the last day. It is written in the prophets, and they shall all be taught by God. Good job by Jesus there, attributing his glory, right. Giving attribution. Everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. Not that anyone has seen the Father except the one who is from God. He has seen the Father. Very truly, I tell you, whoever believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your ancestors ate manna in the wilderness and they died. Look out. Moses catching a stray. Your ancestors ate in the wilderness, manna in the wilderness, and they died. This is the bread that came down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. I'm not sure. Do you think? Wait. Yeah, I think Jesus is the living bread that came down from heaven. Yeah, I think we've gotten that point across. Whoever eats of this bread will live forever, and the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. Sarks. The good news, according to Jesus... of Jesus, according to John.
According to John. Thanks, John.
Attributed appropriately using the old Chicago MLA.
Yeah, that is how you're supposed to do it, I believe, according to the handbook. It is written. It is written.
Indeed. You got anything here, Matt?
Not much.
Yeah, well, I think we're setting up these 3 weeks. And I don't know that, you know, am I looking ahead that 1 week to the other is drastically different than another. I think it's important to know that you're setting up this 3 week and there's a line that's important here. Jesus makes this audacious claim, saying, I'm the bread of life, and people get upset about it. And when they get upset, the second thing they say is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? You get a little bit of it at the end, talking about blood and flesh and stuff, right? I will give for the bread I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. So as we get into that, I think it's setting the stage for us to think about this bread of life stuff and what it means to eat Jesus' body and blood in genealogical terms. That a thing that I will attribute to Robot Molina, as I have many times on this podcast, that in the ancient Near East, the only social system you had for support were the people you were genetically connected to, and that is it, with whom you shared blood. And Jesus is turning that on its head. And what this, a big part of what this metaphor is doing, is redefining your blood. That by eating, you are what you eat, right? And by eating Jesus' body and blood, you now are sharing that genetic material with Jesus. And now you are socially bound and get to benefit socially. That's the good news part of it. From all of the people who are now sharing in this life and stuff with Jesus.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah. Redefining your blood.
And to tie it into your kings can't control everything thing here, I'm perplexed why Jesus throws shade at manna in the wilderness. Dan Erlander, I imagine, is hurt when he hears this. I think that's pretty good. But he hits this, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, he said something pretty similar to it. But it's the idea that you can't buy this family. This is bread that falls from heaven. Again, the main thing, that the reason people did labor in the ancient Near East was to have food to live. And the, you know, vast majority of humans' calories came from bread, in particularly like barley bread. And so bread was why you worked, and it's what you got when you worked. And that was the way to get bread, right? And Jesus is saying here, this bread that's going to give you life is going to fall from the heavens. You can't go to the store. You can't, even if you wanted to, you can't go to the store and buy this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's still challenging for us today, right? Because even if we don't have exactly the same kind of economy as this first century, I mean, the idea that there is bread that we don't have to / cannot buy, I mean, it's just like, what does that even mean? Like, what, like, it's, you're making me question reality. It's like magical realism. Like, what in the world? How do you square this with daily experience of life? And then even to tie that forward with the live forever, I'm curious if there are other translations of those Greek words. I know that you know the Greek words because you're always up on top of those things. But what does that mean? What does it mean, live forever? Like, what? This is a challenge, it feels like, to everything that we know about the world being temporal and temporary, having to work for everything that you have. And Jesus is going to flip that on its head. What does that even mean? And so maybe as a preacher too, it challenges you to think about those things that we know do exist in our lives, to try to find some connections to those things that we can't buy, to those things that where grace shows up in the world, and where maybe we get a glimpse of it here and there, as a glimpse of the greater feast to come.
Yeah.
And redefining your blood also feels like a part of that, right? Because that kind of thing, it's not something you buy. It's something that happens with grace over time. And that, yeah, be interesting to explore that. Pull that.
And that's super complicated, right? The blood is a complicating factor in the David story. Right? That you can see this inability of a community to live into Jesus' new vision of what family looks like. On one hand, you know, you can see David's love of Absalom is, it's particularly graceful and merciful. And yet, it's in no small part because they share blood, right? That they are, it is his son in the old way of seeing family. And David's inability to see all the other people in the kingdom as his son as well causes some trouble for him. And you can start to move into like a more metaphorical understanding of what working for your bread looks like in terms of a community and this redefinition of family, that you've got to work for your bread and the new blood and build up trust and stuff, right? But that's not what Jesus is saying here. Right? You don't have to work for it. It just comes to you.
Yeah. Yeah. All this talk about redefining blood and family just makes me want to talk about Black Widow. So if you want to do your Black Widow sermon, Now's the time.
Is it?
It's a movie all about family. It's all about family, Zach.
Are you talking about redefining Fast and Furious 9?
Family? Oh my goodness. I've never seen any of those movies, but I've seen the Marvel never? Movies, and there's a new one out, and it's about family. So if you really want to preach another Marvel sermon, now's your chance.
You have the time and resources to watch a Premier Access Disney Plus movie, but not enough to get caught up on Loki?
I know, I'm not caught up on Loki. I'm one episode behind. I will say this is what we did last night. We watched Black Widow. And then we're like, oh, you know what? We got to watch In the Heights before it leaves HBO. I wonder when it leaves. Let me just check to make sure we can do it later this week. And it was yesterday was the last day. And it was 10:30 at night. And we're like, let's go. And we stayed until 1 o'clock to finish it. Oh, man.
I imagine the producers from HBO Max have stopped listening at this point and are feverishly trying to contact us to get us to develop an Old Testament TV series. But don't tell them. I have unsubscribed from HBO Max.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. What? Right before Space Jam?
I know.
What are you thinking?
What was I thinking?
A new legacy.
I'll tell you what I was thinking, Matt. I was thinking about the music. I was thinking about making playlists.
That's right. Space Jam is all about the music. What do you listen to?
Well, Matt, I'm reaching the end of my subscription, a complimentary subscription to XM Radio, where I have found myself mostly listening to Tom Petty Radio.
Wow.
A little bizarre, because before Tom Petty died, he recorded a lot of hits for the station, and so he's on it a lot. So that's strange. But we've had a real, I don't know what you'd call this thing happened here in the Old Testament reading, breakdown? In political
breakdown.
Go ahead and give it to me. That's not just Tom Petty, though, Matt. That's Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Putting that on my playlist this week. Also, Matt, shows coming up by the time this airs, I think. No, week of this show, I think I'm going to be headed to the Folks Festival in Lyons, Colorado, put on by Planet Bluegrass. They just announced a new headliner that was enough to push the Vinyl Spouse and I over the edge, because we're going to go on Friday night when Waxahachie is headlining.
Nice.
I'm excited. So I'm going to put Fruits of My Labor, the Waxahachie track off of St. Cloud, her most recent album. And finally, Matt, the obvious Prince song of the week is When Doves Cry, because it's a real sad situation here in the Old Testament.
Indeed. Maybe I'm just like my father.
All right.
Too old. Oh, man. Oh, brutal. Brutal. That is a perfect track. Well, if you want to add one more, I'll throw on Since David and Absalom. Just quite the lookers. How about Prince, The Beautiful Ones?
Uh-huh.
Which is not really about that, but we'll go with it anyway.
Hey,
Prince, The Beautiful Ones.
It's been a long summer for all of us.
Indeed. And then, since we're talking about betrayal and revenge and all these things happening in 2 Samuel, Kendrick Lamar, loyalty.
In my DNA.
And because we're the bread of life, I was like, do you have any songs about bread or food or eating? And
Pace
then
yourself.
I couldn't resist putting the first song about eating that came to mind, which is Weird Al Yankovic. Eat it. It's so good.
Mm-hmm.
He's fantastic.
He's
there
great.
Was a wonderful New York Times long form story about him in the New York Times magazine, I want to say about a year ago, and it was really, really good. That's what I got.
All right. Well, it's been real.
Real final.